The reading today is taken from the book of Daniel, which you'll find on page 891 of the Bibles that we have here in church. I'm going to read the whole of the first chapter. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent, to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favour and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servant for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Get your Bible open there in the book of Daniel. I add my welcome to Bill this evening. If I've not met you before, I'm Tim, and I'm the overall leader, not the only leader here, but the overall leader here at Christchurch Central. Good to welcome you if you're new. Today is a good day if you are new today and it's your first time, because we're beginning this new series. It's always good to come in when everyone else is doing something new as well. You feel less out of it than if we were halfway through the book of Daniel or already. The War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells' story of alien invasion, has it's been reproduced in a variety of ways. Most recently there was Steven Spielberg's film starring Tom Cruise. My favourite adaptation though of War of the Worlds, H.G. Wells' story, is Jeff Wayne's brilliant and haunting musical. And anyone my sort of age, late 30s or early 40s, will sort of remember some of the great riffs and the guitar music in Jeff Wayne's music there. It's brilliant, it's haunting, and I have to say that probably nothing matches Orson Welles' adaptation. I don't know if any of us were around in 1938. I think maybe Bill was around in 1938. Orson Welles put an adaptation out on the radio in the United States of America It actually went out on the 30th of October 1938, an adaptation of H.G. Wells' story of alien invasion. And what should have been an evening of entertainment turned into mass panic as millions of people across America really did believe that the Martians were coming. And the Martians had landed, and they were awesome, and they were powerful, and there was nothing that we were going to be able to do against these Martians that arrived. And so it hit this this mass panic across America. They may say more about Americans, maybe. Who am I to judge? By the way, Steve, who spoke earlier on, was Canadian, so that's why I was brave enough to say it, because he's bigger than me. The terror of being overwhelmed by an awesome, powerful, you know, powerful enemy. It's just got to imagine. I mean, just to remember, if you saw the film with Tom Cruise in it, just, I mean, what do you do about this colossal power? Nothing you can do about it. The sense of absolute fear, the horrifying vulnerability of being powerless to do anything. The desperation of knowing that there's nobody and there's nothing, there's nothing that's going to be able to resist this power that is coming upon you. I mean, if you've ever been beaten up on the street, anyone who's been mugged would know the desperation and the absolute fear of not being able to do anything about this situation. You know, whatever you do, there's nothing you can do. It's happening anyway. That's, I think, is the kind of feel at the beginning of the book of Daniel. The first thing that I want to say from the book today is that there is a perception. The perception is this. The perception is that Babylon reigns. Babylon rules. Daniel, the book of Daniel, just to take you back in time a little bit. The book of Daniel takes us back in history about 2,600 years, okay? About 2,600 years, 600 years before Christ, when the superpower of the day was the Babylonian Empire under King Nebuchadnezzar II. And if the next time you're down in London, or if you're an international student here, and you're going to do a tour of the UK at some point, and you head down to London, and you find yourself in the British Museum, go to room 55, so I hear and read, room 55, and you'll hear all about and see, read all about the Babylonian Empire and this guy Nebuchadnezzar II. What a fearsome man he was. His military might was absolutely awesome. And no nation in that day matched his terrifying power. You've no doubt heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the great wonders of the ancient world, seven great wonders of the ancient world. Well, the architecture of the city of Babylon was immense. It was vast. I mean, I think it's something like around the top of the city walls. You walk around the city walls of somewhere like York, and you know, you could just about hold your, you know, son or daughter's hand as you walk around, and you have to stand aside when other people are coming the other way. Well, on Babylon, though, two four-horse chariots could pass each other on top of the walls. It was huge, vast, and spoke of the power of the king and of the nation. And Babylon, it was a centre of commerce. It was a centre of scientific research, of technological invention, of medicinal development. So there was culture, there was art, and there were 1,200 temples. So Babylon was deeply spiritual, immersed in religion as well as in science and technology. So what hope was there for God's people set up in this little hill country of Judah? What hope was for them? You see on the map that, I mean, the Babylonians went right through and took Egypt, no problem at all. Well, Judah's on its way past through, where it says Israel there, and the Jordan. It was just on the route through, and they just took it on the way. Real power, there's no hope at all. So look at verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who's the king of Judah, the king of God's people, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And nothing more need to be said than verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he, that is Nebuchadnezzar, brought him to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God back there in Babylon. And he placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. See, Nebuchadnezzar just took Jerusalem. Wasn't hard for him at all. He ransacks the most precious part of the city, which is the temple to the living God. And then he takes home with him some of the most precious belongings from the temple to the living God, and he puts them in his trophy cabinet back in Babylon. That's what he does. So the point is a really very, very simple one. Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon rules over the living God. So he goes straight into the house of the living God, grabs the best stuff from there, and puts it in the cabinet in the house of his God. So who's in authority? That's what he says, I am. Babylon rules. Babylon has captured your God and taken him home. You see, the last thing as well that Nebuchadnezzar was is a multiculturalist. So not did he go along in there and take the prized possessions of God's people and take these symbolic articles back to his temple, but he takes some of the young leaders too. See, he wasn't a multiculturalist. There was no kind of you have your God and I'll have mine, and that's okay. We can be kind of like relativists and pluralists. No, not a bit of that at all. He really believed that his God was better than other people's gods, and he really genuinely believed that his culture, his religion, everything was better than everyone else's. And so it was a case of, my God's better than your gods, you bow to my gods. You take my culture on. None of your culture anymore. That's rubbish. There's no political correctness. It was pretty heavy-handed. So he takes some of the cream, the elite, the rulers from the nations he conquered, and he takes them to Babylon, where he puts them through citizenship classes, we could call them perhaps nowadays, and unashamed indoctrination. And not only that, he gives them a taste of wealth, a taste of the good life. He gives them a flavour of what's it like to be Babylonian. And they're taught, they're trained in the best universities. Their egos are pampered as they're turned into Babylonian leaders, basically. Willing servants of the Babylonian cause. Willing servants of Nebuchadnezzar and his plans and his ambition and his cause. So you imagine being one of the undergraduates. You'd soon get over your first term homesickness, wouldn't you, in verses 3 to 5 when what's on offer to you? The wealth and the opulence as you arrive in his fantastic cities with the hanging gardens of Babylon for you to perhaps walk around in when you're doing a little bit of your, revision for your exams. Look there again at verses 3 to 5. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate. Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it? And of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. You're being prepared for high office here, and on the way you're sharing the king's table. Soon not be missing mummy and daddy so quick, wouldn't you? And just to ensure the Babylonianization of these young men. They were cut off from their roots, They were cut off spiritually and religiously from their heritage. Everything that they found precious was wiped away, as it were, and is replaced, so that they kind of wipe the slate clean, erase what's there, put it all in the bin, and clean it all, and then start refilling them with new ideas and new spirituality and new culture. They start to reprogram them. And hence the changing of names there in verses 6 to 7. I'll explain what some of these names mean, because the names are very, very important in what's going on here. You'll see. Daniel, look at the verses 6 to 7 there. Daniel, whose name means God is my judge, well, he's renamed Belteshazzar. So his name is changed from God is my judge to the God Bel preserves my life. Hananiah, which means the Lord is gracious, in fact that's the name of God, isn't it? The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and swift to love and to forgive. Well, Hananiah, his name means the Lord is gracious, his name named Shadrach, which means the moon god Aku is my commander. Alright? Mishael, which means who is what God is? Well, the answer is nothing, nobody. God is entirely separate. I mean, who is what God is? Well, God is holy. That name speaks of the holiness and the otherness of God, the living God. He's renamed Meshach, which means who is what the moon god Aku is. And Azariah, which means God helps, was renamed Abednego, which means servant of Nebo, god of the planet Mercury. Where Nebuchadnezzar has his name linked in there somewhere too with that particular god. So everything's wiped away and they're reprogrammed. Well, that's the attempt. The point again is very, very simple. Firstly, God rules over Babylon. The point that Nebuchadnezzar makes is that Babylon rules over God. And secondly, in this first main point, Babylon rules over God's people. Change the names, make them into Babylonians, erase all the stuff from the past and make them into, change them into different people. It's interesting because from this point on in the Bible, just taking a wider picture for a moment, from this point on in the Bible, Babylon becomes a symbol for powers, for authorities, for cultures, for subcultures, that will push themselves in on God's people and seek to swallow up God's people and assimilate God's people, and in doing so erase anything of their own right and proper Christian spiritual heritage and give them a new one. Babylon becomes symbolic of that through the rest of the Bible, to push out God and replace God with other philosophies, other world views. Babylon seeks to assimilate God's people, swallow them up, indoctrinate them, and obliterate their spiritual identity. And so today, I read and I hear of Christian leaders talking about the Babylons of today in Britain and in the West being secularism and pluralism and relativism and those other isms that even the church begins to take it on board. The church used to one day stand very solidly and say Jesus is Lord, but now you'll find plenty of leaders who say, well, actually, well, he's one Lord amongst many. They become relativists. And secularism as well, we begin to buy into the fact that, what does religion have to do with politics? And we read our newspapers and we read it time and time again. In the last few days, with all this debate going on about the equality law that's coming into power and adoption of children and these Christian institutions that would not want to having gay couples come to seek adoption of a child. Well, they're no longer going to be allowed to do that. Well, one of the things that struck me in all this conversation that's going on is every time Ruth Kelly, the culture secretary, is mentioned, it's always Ruth Kelly who is a Roman Catholic. Now that's probably going to affect what she thinks. Is that right? And we get lulled into, well, no, perhaps our religion shouldn't. See, we've become secularists. But above all, actually, Babylon, in the Bible, Babylon's aim is to turn Christians into materialists and consumerists and hedonists. That's actually what Babylon does. Just keep your place here in Daniel and bear with me by turning to the very back of the Bible. Keep your place, like I say, in Daniel, to Revelation chapter 18, page 1247. And here the back of the Bible tells us about the judgment and the destruction of Babylon. And in telling us about the destruction of Babylon, the Bible tells us what Babylon stands for. And it's pretty clear, it's materialism and consumerism and hedonism. And so verse 2 there, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. It's hedonism, isn't it? Consumerism. Materialism. Come out of her, verse 4 says, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped up high in heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. And she glorified herself and lived in luxury to give her like measure for torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as queen, I'm no widow, and mourning I shall never see. For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire for mighty is the Lord God who will judge her. And then verse 10, alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. Why? Verse 14, the fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you. All your delicacies and your splendours are lost to you, never to be found again. Verse 16, alas, alas, for that great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels and with pearls. You get the picture, don't we? And it goes on about the end of commercialism, doesn't it? And craftsmen, all these people doing wonderful jobs there, the ships in verse 19, the great ships doing this merchant and moving stuff about the world. And the trumpeters and the musicians and the craftsmen there, and you know, it all comes to an end. See, Babylon, and I mean, we're meeting in the Lake Bar, and so much of what goes around us in the city centre stands for materialism and hedonism. So much of our culture, it lives for these things, and we do too, unless we're very careful. Babylon seeks to turn God's people into, like I say, materialists, consumerists and hedonists. I don't know if you've seen the film School of Rock. Can you just raise your hand if you've seen the film School of Rock? Great, good. I'm talking with a number of people. If you've not seen it, just look around again to those people who put their hands up. It's a great film. Jack Black is the main man in it. He's a guy who is in a rock band. He gets rejected from the rock band and he's unemployed and eventually takes up a job illegally as a teacher. He gets this job pretending to be a teacher and discovers that he can make a rock band out of the class that he's teaching and enter the competition that his former rock band is in, because he just wants to beat them and win this competition. So he turns all these kids into rock musicians. Well, it's a very nice school. The kids are lovely, middle class kids. I mean, Ashdale perhaps is the equivalent here in Sheffield. Lovely kids, never do anything wrong. You go to Ashdale, I've got a friend who's a youth worker, and you go to Ashdale and lovely girls, I mean, they actually curtsy to you, the youth worker, when you walk in to do an assembly. I mean, it doesn't happen in our school, it's a Christian school, they just ignore you. You know, I mean, so that's the kind of school that Jack Black goes and teaches in, and these guys just haven't got the rock attitude. So he starts teaching them about the man. And of course, well, the man, in his terms, is the man, anybody or anything that just wants to shape you into themselves. It's the head teacher, the head mistress, she's the man. You know, she wants to shape you into a goody-goody. So he's trying to embed in them a little bit of rock and a bit of attitude and a bit of the rebel. Now, watch out for the man. For Christians, Babylon is the man. He'll seek to change us. And we've got to watch the man. And we've got to rebel against the man. Against Babylon. Babylon is seductive, believable, and powerful. In this war of the worlds, Babylon reigns, but I say that is only a perception. So my second main point, the reality is that God reigns. The reality is that God reigns. There's a particular phrase that is repeated three times here in chapter 1. The first time it is used is there in verse 2. The Lord gave. Look at verse 2. Nebuchadnezzar marches on Jerusalem, and he goes to take this city, and he thinks he's done it himself, doesn't he? But verse 2 tells us, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with the vessels. The Lord gave them. He didn't take them. The Lord was in control. So although it may have seemed that appearances can be deceptive, the fact is this: God rules over Babylon. And Daniel tells us that God gave his people into the hands of the Babylonians, and it was in fact actually an act of judgment by God. And in other parts of the Bible, we find that the people rebel against God. They turn actually to idols and to serving and worshipping idols. And so what God does, ironically, is send an idolatrous nation in to take them over. And many of them are taken away to the city of idols. And they're given names of idols. God hands them over to what they've been wanting. That's his judgment. You want it, have it. It's not nice. But God is in charge, though. He's the one who hands them over to the Babylonians. God's rule is really crucial through the rest of the story. And we see it here in chapter 1. Daniel, right there in verse 2, says that the Lord God, the living God, no matter what it might look like, he is still in control. And it's absolutely crucial to the whole plot in the book of Daniel. You see, it's seeing past the perception. It's actually looking beyond the perception to the reality, at the big picture, as it were, to see the whole that actually makes the book of Daniel such a fantastic book to read. See, some of the most famous parts of the story only happen because the people, the little people in the story, see the big picture. They believe and they trust the big picture. So Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, or as sometimes they're spoken about in Sunday school, your shack, my shack and a bungalow, they see past Nebuchadnezzar's authority, they see past his terrifying power to the reality that God is actually in charge, and so they end up in the fiery furnace. We're not going to bow down your idol. Because God's sovereign. He's in charge. They see it. And they live it. And they believe it. That's why they don't swerve away from God. And later on as well, we come to Daniel, who ends up in the lion's den. He ends up there for the same reason. Because he knows God is God. God's in charge over Nebuchadnezzar. And all the other fearsome, powerful things that are all around. God rules over Babylon. And like I said, we see it right here in chapter 1. And look at the other two places where that little phrase, and God, or the Lord gave. It's there in verse 9. Look at verse 9. And God gave Daniel favour and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And then turn over to verse 17, top of the next page. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. It was God who did it. So contrary to what looks to be the case, God is God over Babylon, and more than that, God rules over his own people still. God rules over his people, and that's never stopped being the case, even though it may seem to have been the case. God is still ruling. So Daniel and his friends in verse 8 and following, Daniel and his friends, they take everything on board. They don't complain about the new names. They don't have any student strikes about what they're learning. They don't boycott lectures. They're model students, they're model citizens, they're conformists in many ways to their new culture. In fact, they end up being the best students, performing brilliantly in their end of year examinations, graduating with first class honours. Look at verses 18 to 20. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. They got the best jobs. They did brilliantly. And every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And it was a big kingdom we saw on the map earlier on. So they do well, these guys do. But over one specific issue, they make a stand. They make a stand. They resolve. Look back at verse 8 again. That's a strong word, that. They resolved. They thought about it. They planned it. They made a decision. They resolved to make a stand. It wasn't just kind of like, oh, hang on, we're going to do this. No. They were very clear about it. That word resolution. They resolved to dare to be different. To dare to be different. To be non-conformists. Their choice of stand would have been understandable with the meals at my university halls of residence, if I'm modest. We used to have rabbit stew on a Friday. Back in the 80s, rabbit stew on a Friday evening at my halls of residence, and it wasn't very nice to eat. The alternative was similarly not very nice to eat, but these guys had the best food in the world, cooked by the best chefs in the world. Who else would have Nebuchadnezzar had cooking his food for him other than the best? That was their, that's what was on offer to them. But they said, no, we're not going to eat that. We're not going to eat the king's food. That's where they stood their ground there. Verse 8, Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. But why? Why didn't they eat the king's meals? This is a conundrum which, people speaking on Daniel 1 always ask the question, and it's written in all the books, why did they make the stand here? And there's all sorts of answers given, and let me offer you mine and some other people's as well as we go. Some people say, well, it had been offered perhaps to idols. Well, possibly, but it's likely that the vegetables that they ate were offered to idols anyway, okay, so we can't really be sure about that. Perhaps the meat wasn't kosher and would have been forbidden to Jews. That's perhaps another reason that some people give. Well, what about the wine? They rejected that as well. Perhaps other people will say that eating the king's food was a great sign of fellowship and an alliance being made between them. And allegiance being made, sharing the table, sharing the food. Well, yes, that was true, very true actually, in the culture of the day. And if you're taking notes, make a note of chapter 11, verse 26 of Daniel, and you can make a little cross reference where eating with others is a great sign of fellowship and unity. There's no such thing as a free lunch, they say, and so eating the king's table, you'd have been in his pocket, and there you are making an allegiance with him. I think there's some truth in that. The thing that I concerns me about it, most of the discussions about why they stood to make their point over the food, is that it kind of trains our minds to think in this way: how far do I go before I fall into sin? Which I think the whole of the Bible tells you to go the other way. How holy do you have to be in order to be pleasing to God? Jesus' understanding of the Ten Commandments is all about maximising the application, not minimising the meaning. But the whole Bible speaks that way to us. So for a part of it to be suddenly saying, well, actually, think how far you can go, and then you'll find a line with which you mustn't go, it doesn't ring true. So I'm a little bit dissatisfied with that myself. Although I've not really kind of come to any sort of other thoughts than what I'm about to tell you now. The thing I find striking is this: whatever the reason they chose not to eat the meat and the wine from the king, I find this striking. Chapter 1 is all about who rules in this war of war between the worlds. Which king? Nebuchadnezzar and the mighty Babylonian Empire? Or is it the living God of the Bible? Daniel and his friends, they see the reality and they act accordingly. Their original names speak of dependence on God. Their given names speak of utter dependence upon Nebuchadnezzar and his gods and Babylon. See, Babylon was attempting to eradicate God from their lives, but their choice of food made sure that that didn't happen. By saying, "We will not eat that king's food," they made quite a serious stand. And sometimes people say, well, actually, because they were able to make the stand here in chapter 1, they were able to make the stand later on and over being thrown into the fiery furnace, and it's kind of like passing your GCSEs in order to your A-levels. I don't think that's right. I think they make a huge stand here. They actually say, for our daily bread, we're going to be dependent upon the living God. And the eunuch knows that it could be the death of him. The king will have my head if I don't look after you well and you're not eating his food. I said, well, no. Just give us vegetables and we'll rely upon the living God. I think this goes right to the heart of the matter. Whose king is your king? Who are you depending on? Who do you really believe is in control? Babylonian king? Or the Lord of creation? I think that fits with the whole setup of Daniel 1, of this war of worlds and this question of which king you're going to serve and which king is truly in charge. Now, did you know that the Jesus' favourite title of referring to himself first comes in the Bible in the book of Daniel? Just keep your place there in Daniel 1 and turn over to Daniel chapter 7. More than any other title, Jesus spoke of himself as the Son of Man. Okay? That might sound humble in comparison to saying the Son of God. But who is the Son of Man according to Daniel? Well, he's none other than the living God. The eternal ruler of everything. He goes on and on ruling forever, does the Son of Man. Look at Daniel 7 and verses 13 and 14. This is Daniel's vision. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, all nations and all languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Who's king? Well, Daniel yearns and looks forward to the coming of the Son of Man, the Lord Jesus Christ. And Jesus takes that title for himself. It's seeing the reality that the God of the Bible, it's seeing the reality of this Son of Man, who is Jesus Christ. That is the God of the Bible. Jesus Christ is the God of the Bible. He rules and he reigns forever over everybody and everything. And once you see that big picture, and then you can act with guts and courage. Once you see that, you can dare to be different. Of course you can dare to be different if you believe, if that's true, and you believe in that to be true. One more place to turn on to, Book of Acts. Keep your place in Daniel, page 1103. The first Christian martyr was a guy called Stephen. And he's in court, and in the end the courts get completely fed up with what he's saying, page 1103, and they hound him out, and they're outside, and they stone him to death. Now, what allows Stephen to go through that brutality and die? What does Stephen see before his death? What gives him the bottle, the guts to stand out? Verse 54 of Acts 7. And when they heard these things as the court, they were enraged, and they ground their teeth at Stephen,
But he, full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God. And he said, behold, I see the heavens opened and the... who?
The Son of Man.
The Son of Man standing at the right hand of God.
Take him out and stone him. He can do it because he believes God is. The God of the Bible is the Lord of the entire earth. So who rules? Who rules over this country? Who rules over your nation if you're an international? Who rules over your university? Who rules over the students' union? Who rules over the company you work for? Who rules over the NHS? Who rules over your school? Who rules over the owner of the business that you work for? Who rules over the shareholders? Who rules over the head of your department? Who rules over your colleagues? Who rules over your building society? Who rules over your landlord? Who rules over your tax inspector? Who rules over Muslims and Jews and Hindus and Mormons and atheists and agnostics and Christians? Who rules over this church? Who rules over your family? Who rules over your parents? Who rules over your children? Who rules over your career? Who rules over the days of your week? Who rules over your future? Who rules over where you live? Who rules over your love life? I had that written down before I heard that they were engaged over there. Who rules over your sexuality? Who rules over your relationships? Who rules over your ambitions? Who rules over your pride? Who rules over you? Get the answer to that right, and you better live for God. Our answer will shape our lives, our lifestyles, our habits, our ethics, all of our choices. And of course, if someone to take a closer look at our lives, our habits and our ethics and our choices, they'd soon better tell who we really did think ruled. It works both ways. A little illustration I've got. I try and collect various things that I read and observe in a little book of illustrations I've got, and I got this a little bit too late to put it up on the overhead the PowerPoint this evening. But it's a tiger in a Thai zoo. It's been nursing a litter of piglets as her own, and there's a little picture here. I'll show it to Jim at the front and ask him about it at the end. There you are, Jim. Little nice tiger and little piglets lying around her and over her, and they've all got little tiger jackets on just so she doesn't confuse them. She's suckling these things, and I took a look at that and I thought, goodness me, that's like eating from the King of Babylon's table. Now this could turn around at any moment and eat you up. Funny enough, we do it to pigs anyway ourselves, don't we? Never mind tigers. Babylon is seductive and is powerful, and it's so easy to be nursed by it and to believe that it actually gives us life. Whereas in actual fact, it'll be the death of us. It's a predator. We can put our little tiger jackets on and look like cute little tigers, but we're still pigs to a tiger. Our only salvation is the Son of Man, the living God. And I hope that over these next weeks, as we look at the book of Daniel together, we'll have a few more stories of people coming up front, like Stephen. Thanks, Stephen, for turning up. You saved Dan. Turning up the front, people sharing about where they work, and perhaps in the weeks to come, sharing about some of the difficulties, the ethical choices you face, and what helps you to stand. And we'll make this thing live for us, 2,600 years after it was originally written, because the Lord is the same Lord. And there's opportunity in our teams, in our small groups, we call them Gamma Teams here at Christchurch Central, and the students and the internationals, to also think these issues through. So how do we stand and demonstrate that God is our God and nothing and nobody else is?